So I think I met everybody. How's it sound okay? I think I met everybody as you were coming in, and some of you I've known before. I'm Sue Zappel, one of the assistant teachers. And it's kind of challenging to give the last talk, especially since my wonderful colleagues and I, we've met a few times, but nobody really said what they were going to say. So I was a little nervous as I was writing this talk. But Nana brought up the ouch of suffering. I'm going to talk about that. Nina talked about doing positive reflection. Judith shared so much about how connected we are and how we can feel helpless and sitting with our feelings. So I'm hoping that what I'm going to share is going to be of benefit. You know, when we first decided to do this day-long, and the Four Noble Truths, especially, you know, the first one, the Buddha said, I teach two things, that suffering and the end of suffering. And it can sound pretty gloomy. You know, where there's suffering, it's caused by our clinging, and we're instructed to kind of clean up our act in terms of views and intentions and actions. This afternoon, what I'd like to talk about is practicing with all of the different teachings that we've covered this morning and afternoon through the lens of joy. It's not only my belief, but my experience that practicing and living with and embodying the Dhamma leads to a very joyful life. It's said that one of the things that really prompted the Buddha to teach after his enlightenment was that he realized that all these people wanted to be happy, and yet to a person they were doing things that did not bring them happiness. So he wanted to figure out how to put together some teachings that would guide us in that way. So I humbly offer some of my own ideas as to how you can practice with these teachings through a lens of joy. But a disclosure. So some of my friends here know that I have this identity whose name is Susie Sunshine. She is, you can take her in small doses. After I worked on my talk, I went back and looked at it, and I said, okay, who's given this talk? Is Susie Sunshine giving the talk? Or is Suze, who's a serious Dharma practitioner? My hope is that the latter is the one who's showing up, but just needed to kind of give a little disclosure just in case. So the First Noble Truth, and Nana did such a great job in talking about it, it's like, when we actually feel the ouch of whatever the suffering is that's shown up, didn't get what we wanted, or we got too much of what we wanted, or we're disappointed in this, or the world is what the world is. When we actually sit with it, when we don't push it away, we don't repress it, we don't put sugar on it. One of my ways of putting sugar on it is, oh, I think I'll do metta practice. That's not how one deals with the truth of the ouch. But when we actually sit and bring the fullness of our attention, all of our best mindfulness to what is actually happening in the moment, and we feel it in the body, we bring our discernment and wisdom, we cut through some of the delusion and the storylines that come up. We know it. The suffering doesn't go away, but it does go through a kind of transformation. It's what happens when we actually receive the moment in its entirety. We don't get angry at it. It's just what is. We don't call it a problem either, that we have to fix it. While we may not be at ease with what's going on, with whatever shows up, we're kind of on our way to that place of ease. I've shared many times in the Sunday Sangha, my partner of 35 years went out for a run 8 years ago and had a rip in his aorta and died. My world flipped upside down, and my practice, oh, this is the word, it sounds a little extreme, but it saved me in that I came up with this mantra, may I trust in the natural unfolding of life, and may I receive that unfolding with wisdom and understanding. Where the suffering of the moment might not be your partner's death, but it might feel just as life upturning upside down kind of moment. And when we're able to fully experience it, in all its everything, the messiness of it, the bad feelings of it, sometimes the glory of it, we have access to a kind of ease, a kind of joy. Tessa just said in the discussion, how do I bring moments of freedom to the day? I think that's one of the things, one of the questions that we can sit with when that suffering is so present. Is there even a second, an opening? Can I find some moment of freedom? So that's how you find some joy, I think, with the first noble truth. The second noble truth, whew, we cling to the belief that we can actually stop being tossed around by the eight worldly winds. Are people familiar with that teaching? Anybody? A few? So these are the four pairs that always come together: pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. But we could add a whole bunch of other pairs just from our discussions today. You know, grief and anger, sadness and joy, despair and hopefulness. There's a huge list of emotional winds and these eight worldly winds that just kind of sneak up and bat us around. And as with all phenomena, they arise and they stay, hang out for a while, and then they pass away. Seeing these mind states as wind can really be a helpful way of practicing with them. Winds blow and recede. A way to look at it sometimes is it's all weather. And the only thing we do about weather, knowing that we live in the Pacific Northwest, is we add clothing. And we, you know, everybody wears all these layers, right? You know, that's what we deal with weather. There's some wonderful monastic women who have set up sanghas in the Pacific Northwest. Two of them wrote this sweet little book. The book is called Leaving It All Behind. It's Bhikkhuni Santachitta and Bhikkhuni Anandabodhi. And they talk a lot about these eight worldly winds. And I'm going to ask you to do something if people are willing. I'd like everybody to stand up for a bit. And those of you online as well. And if you can't stand, you can do this in a chair. But really get your feet really under you. You might want to get off of the zabutan just to make sure you're really settled. Have your knees really loose. But feel how solid those feet are on the floor. And then just slowly kind of shift from left to right. Feel your weight just kind of shift a little. Maybe move your arms a little around. Oops, I have to be careful of this. Just kind of move around a little bit, feeling the flexibility of your upper body while you feel the strength and solidity of the lower. This body experience, for any of you who do any kind of yoga or Tai Chi or Qigong, it's that beautiful combination of grounded and flexible. And that's what I want to talk about with the eight worldly winds. So taking that, let's sit back down. When we're grounded, we're really solid, not only in our bodies, but grounded in our discernment and in our wisdom, we can see how we cling to things, how we try to hold on to things, or how we push them away. I had a lovely conversation with somebody today, and I so identified with this person's experience. They went on a retreat, and it was fabulous. Then they wanted the same retreat. Anybody have that same experience? You know, I mean, is that not what we humans do? But we're grounded and we tap into our courage, our commitment to being really honest with ourselves, and then we're being flexible. We're open to what shows up. And we know that it's all just weather. Bhikkhuni Santachitta, in the book she wrote, says, these four pairs of winds are a way of speaking about how life feels when we relate to everything in terms of me and mine. It's an endless and unpleasant cycle of wanting, getting, losing, satisfaction, disappointment, ups and downs. She says this cycle is probably what brought many of us to the path to begin with. But she reminds us that it's all just weather. And she also says that even if you're enlightened, fall still turns into winter. Winter still turns into spring. The winds still come and bat you around. I really like the image of be like a tree being tossed by the wind. I love trees. I touch them a lot and talk to them when I'm out in the woods. And the tree is so grounded, yet flexible. The winds come, bat it around. It doesn't fall over. It's grounded, yet flexible. When we approach this second noble truth, the clinging, with that kind of balanced, grounded, and flexible, we can really see things for what they actually are. We don't have to take ownership of the wind that has shown up. We can notice the story that's built up and then let it go. We can say, as one of the nuns says in the book, stop making such a big deal out of this. Do you ever notice in your mind what a big deal we make out of something? Sometimes little, like the fight Judith was talking about. She couldn't even remember what the fight was about. But that didn't stop the papancha just going on and on, right? You know, stop making such a big deal out of it. Or she also says, make a truce with these eight worldly winds. There's a huge amount of energy in the winds that we don't want to block, but we want to use them for those moments of freedom that Tessa was talking about. Find an image that might work for you. For me, that image of be like a tree really helps. Santachitta actually recommends that you make your own prayer flag so that you get a pole and you get some fabric and you put on the fabric maybe a mantra or a few words that really matter to you. And when you're battered by that suffering that shows up, those winds, you see as the pole isn't going anywhere. And the flag just moves around. And that's all that's really happening. So I'm going to skip over the third noble truth till the end and get into the Eightfold Path. So my colleagues have shared such wonderful talks. I think one of the most important pieces of it all is how real kama is. Kama just means action. We all are heirs of our own karma. Everything we do, for good or for ill, of that we will be the heir. All of our actions have consequences. They all matter. And we keep doing those actions. We practice. We practice right view and intentions. We practice kindness and compassion. We trust ourselves. We know what our sila, our moral compass is. And we bring a sense of questioning, are my actions aligned with what I feel is most important? We stop often to reflect on our actions. We feel how good it feels when our speech really lands with someone. It was going to be a hard conversation. You spent a little time thinking of it. You mostly kind of spoke from the heart. You didn't overthink it. And you saw the reaction in your friend and that light in their eyes where they really got the kindness or the thoughtfulness that you were sharing. Perhaps we have a set of questions that we ask ourselves about how aligned we are in the day. One of the Zen teachers that used to visit Seattle Insight for years used to suggest that you start the day with setting some intention of how you wanted to live that day. And at the end, you just ask yourself, how did I do? Not to set up a shaming, blaming thing, but to really go, oh, you know what? That interaction I had, that was good. Yeah, I did really well there. Oh, this other one, well, I need to work on that a little bit. But to really reflect on, are our actions aligned? We kind of have a regular kind of assessment tool for ourselves. One of the best tools, and I've come to this one kind of kicking and screaming over the years, is the parami of renunciation. When we studied the paramis last year, one of our colleagues reminded us of when the Buddha first talked about it. He said, you know, my heart did not leap up at the idea of renunciation. But then I thought about both the benefits and the drawbacks of whatever I was reflecting on and whatever I was considering needing to let go. Nana used the phrase earlier, ehi pasiko, see for yourself. So we see for ourselves what's skillful, what's wholesome, what isn't skillful or wholesome. Sometimes some of our behaviors, some of our patterns are beneficial in one way, but then when you also are willing to add the drawbacks, that list might be pretty long or big. It might say, I don't think this drawback is really aligned with how you want to show up in the world. We choose the wholesome, we choose the skillful, on and on. And when we do that, there's a kind of ease that happens. I've gotten pretty good at apologizing. I believe that it's an important skill to have, and especially if you make a lot of mistakes, it's good. But it's really lovely. It's kind of a moment of freedom or joy when you realize, I don't have to apologize for any of this. I done good. You know, you've been practicing your actions. You've been practicing your speech. You keep coming back to, how am I aligned with what is really important in my life? And we experience the joy of that. And of course, as everybody has said, suffering isn't going to end. I start every meditation with the five recollections. I am of the nature to get old. I am not exempt from aging. I am of the nature to get sick. I am not exempt from the truth of illness and diminishment. I am of the nature to die. I am not exempt from the truth of that I am going to be dead. Everyone and everything that I hold dear is of the nature to change. I am not exempt from losing everything I hold dear. And I am the heir to my karma. So that what's happened for me with having that be such an important part of my practice is that the nature of being human is that aging, illness, death, and loss are part of what comes with this package of beauty and music and friendship and sangha and dhamma and children and the smell of babies' heads and, you know, all the joys that we have, but it all is a mix. So today and kind of throughout this whole year at Seattle Insight, every time we get together, people talk about their deep distress and pain at what's happening in our world. It's a very painful time. And I wanted to share some advice that comes from the tradition that I was raised in, which is the Jewish tradition. It's an old rabbinic tradition called the Pirkei Avot. And here are the words. Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justly now. Love mercy now. Walk humbly now. You're not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it. It's just like the Buddha's words, you know, pay attention, know what you value, and act from that. I think it's important to not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. We need to hold it, and as many have said earlier today, from the time of recorded history, I think it was Judith who said that there's never been a time without a war. You know, our country was founded on slavery. The caste system still exists everywhere. Misogyny is alive and well. The list goes on. I find those words really helpful. At the same time, we need to think about what do we do with these hearts that feel like they're constantly being broken? And I think people have talked today about what I call heart care practices. I'll share a few of mine, and maybe in our next discussion you can do that as well. Connection with nature is a first one for me. Trees, plants, birds. I raised my cucumbers from seed this year, and I raised way too many. And you know how cucumbers and squashes do this too? They've got these little teeny strings that come out, and they wrap around and they attach, and they're so strong. They're just kind of amazing. I've just heard of this book called The Light Eaters. It's about plants and what plants do with photosynthesis and stuff. I mean, it's miraculous. It's like, didn't Einstein say, everything is either a miracle or nothing is? Well, in my experience, it seems like everything is. So another heart care practice, which people have talked about today, which is to just do some acts of kindness, deliberately do acts of kindness every day, whether it's talking to friends, sending a card to somebody who might need a little extra love, giving someone some nice feedback. A couple of our Sangha friends have had a daily gratitude practice that they share with each other they've been doing that for several years. For me, one of the things that is my heart care practice is I'm very involved in Seattle Insight. I volunteer. I come up with new ideas. I suggest this. I do that. I've been one of the beneficiaries of being part of SIMS since it started 27 years ago. And it's been great. So just in closing, I want to just remind us all of all the different tools that people have been talking about of how do we really embody these Four Noble Truths. And the very basic is having a regular sitting practice. And not just a sitting practice, but a mindfulness practice that you take with you throughout your day. And sometimes it's hard because we're, like people have talked about, we have our habits. I've known people who set little alarms on their computers, so they take a break every however many minutes, and they breathe, and they just kind of, what's happening in my body? What's happening in my mind? How crazy am I right now? I sit with a couple women every Wednesday morning, and this past Wednesday, when I sat down, I had such a chatty mind, and my to-do list was just like flashing in neon. And then I started my sit, I did my recollections, I set an intention, and I felt the quiet that comes from that first moment when you sit down and you know what you're going to do. And it was such a gift because, you know, there was still some chatting, but the to-do list kind of went all the way, but you know, it stopped. There was no neon. It went all the way to the back burner, and you could just feel the joy that happens when you reconnect with that quiet. For years, I've realized, our founding teacher, Rodney, used to say this, but I never understood it until I finally got it one day. You can find quiet anywhere, anytime, in the midst of a rock concert. Seriously, because the quiet is in here. It's, where am I? What am I doing? Where's my mind? Where's my body? What am I paying attention to? So mindfulness, number one. I already said that aging, illness, death, and loss, the five recollections, I think it's a good part of one's practice. We have these minds, these sometimes they're so crazy. We're taught in Buddhism, don't believe everything you think. And yet, ehi passico, trust what you see, you know, see for yourself. And so we have to really practice clear seeing. We have to do like Nina did, I see you, Mara. If the Buddha never saw Mara, our world would be different. There would be no teachings, I imagine. But anyway, clear seeing. And really be like a tree in the wind. I think if we approach our lives and the external conditions with that sense of grounded and flexible, knowing how we're aligned, that where do we have agency and a voice and where do we not? What are we making a big deal out of and what are we not? I think there are doors opening to joy pretty much all the time. And then the third noble truth. It took me years to even, I'd go first noble truth, yeah, got it. Second, yeah. Then I jumped to the Eightfold Path. Because what did I know about the ending of suffering? I never even knew it was a possibility. If you go on the Sims website to recorded talks, Christina Feldman gave a weekend some years ago on the Third Noble Truth. It's fabulous. Her talks are so good. The way I got a relationship with the Third Noble Truth is I started reflecting on how my life had changed because of my Dharma practice. And I really encourage people to do that. Yes, doubt will show up. And you'll go, what? I barely know how to sit. You know, my mind is always blah, 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 whatever. I mean, whatever your mind is saying, probably everybody else's mind has said too. But we One of our visiting teachers, Philip Moffat, says, what we do is we practice practice. So you practice and you practice, and then you pretty regularly reflect. Like when some months ago, Nana gave a great talk on, and he said, how do you know when you've actually been practicing well? And one of the things he said is that there was less reactivity. Have you noticed that things happen and instead of bong, you know, what do you mean? And then, you know, you pause. You're not as reactive as you used to be. The pausing is just a natural thing that has happened from the practice. We go on retreats. We come to day longs. We get involved with Sangha and we have Sangha Dharma friends and we talk about practice. And the more we reflect on our practice, it builds a kind of confidence. It really does a number on that fifth hindrance of doubt because we go, oh, right. I mean, for me, one of the key moments happened when my son, when he was a grown up, an adult in his late 20s, said, can I come to meditation with you? I go, yeah. And I said, well, why? He said, I've been watching you. And I like what I see. So you've been watching yourself and you can like what you see. So in closing, somebody already said this earlier in the discussion, but life is so much bigger than the troubles we're so caught up with on this small square of concrete or this building or this mind or this country or this moment. Life is so much bigger. We stand in the middle of it like a tree being battered by the wind. We're grounded, we're flexible, we're aware and mindful. We receive what life has to send us, and there's a way that we receive it that's easeful. There's a kind of peace in it. There's no argument, even when we don't like it. There's this voice that says, hey, honey, it's just preference. That's all it is. It's just this moment you'd rather have that than this. You know, well, this is what's here. And there's such a sense of joy that can permeate one's life when we practice really the basis of the teaching. Be with life as it is. And then we celebrate it. Happy celebrating. Thanks for your kind attention.